Welcome to Nuclear Energy in Korea, a podcast to promote discussion of major issues and challenges in U.S. and Korean nuclear energy. I'm Alan Ahn, and I'll be your host today. I'm here with Professor Allison McFarland, Professor of Environmental Science and Policy at George Mason University and member of the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future, formed to address issues of spent nuclear fuel in the U.S. Professor McFarland, it's an honor to be here with you today, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Just to start off, you are a geologist by training. Did you have any idea that you would eventually be working on nuclear energy issues or that you would become a member of a body like the Blue Ribbon Commission?
Not at all. Not at all.
How did you get involved in issues such as spent nuclear fuel and nuclear waste management then?
Well, it wasn't an obvious route. I got my PhD in geology and I ended up teaching at geology, actually at George Mason of all places. In the early 1990s, and I, you know, was thinking about doing more with geology, but I also was a little frustrated with it and was interested in more practical things. And so I started talking to some colleagues. My advisor actually had suggested I look into the issues of nuclear waste. He thought that there wasn't enough geology informing the discussion, and he was right. And I talked to a lot of people who kindly gave me their time and encouraged me, and I decided to try for some fellowships. I got one at the Bunting Fellowship at Radcliffe, and that allowed me to work with John Holdren, who had just arrived at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and it was off to the races. I never looked back.
How and through what process were you selected for or as a member for the Blue Ribbon Commission? I understand that all the members are doing this on a volunteer basis.
Right, they are. I have no idea by what process I was selected. I just got a phone call in December saying, would you be interested in doing this? And I said, sure. And I think there was some more behind the scenes vetting. And then in January, I was told that I would be one of the 15 members.
Did they offer any incentive to you to join, or was this...
Serve your country.
Talking about the Blue Ribbon Commission itself, one of the cases that the BRC focused on and found particularly informative and influential to the commission's decisions was the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP. And for some of our listeners who don't know, it's near Carlsbad, New Mexico, currently the only operating underground facility for long-lived waste in the world.
In the world, yep. Okay. Mm-hmm.
There have also been some very preliminary discussions about possibly expanding WIP into a permanent repository for spent fuel. What would be the steps necessary in order to make this a reality?
In part, it depends on what exactly they expand to accept. If they expand to accept just high-level waste and spent fuel from the Department of Energy, from the nuclear weapons complex, there's maybe some fewer steps than if they were to accept spent fuel from the commercial nuclear industry. So certainly laws will have to be changed, because there are laws within the state and the federal government that say that the only materials being put into WIP will be from the nuclear weapons complex, and they will be transuranic wastes. And so those laws would have to be changed. And, you know, there would have to be agreements with the state to make it comfortable with that expansion of duties. There's been discussion about not actually using WIP itself, but a piece of land near WIP, which I think a number of the residents of Carlsbad have already gone ahead to try to purchase, if they haven't already done so. So that may mean that these laws wouldn't have to be fulfilled. I'm not sure. But there clearly would be some major steps that would have to happen before this came to fruition.
And with regard to not the land around WIP itself, but somewhere near it, would that be a similar geology to...
I assume so, yeah. You know, it's still in this bedded salt. And I don't know the specific geology of that location. I don't know exactly where it is, but it would still be bedded salt. Whether it's as good a location as WIP or not, I'm not sure. And WIP is not without its faults, mind you. In my mind, one of the major downfalls of WIP is the high potential for future human intrusion. Because it's located in a place where there has been a lot of potash mining, when you stand at the doorway to WIP, essentially, and you look out across the semi-desert there, what you see very nearby is an old potash mine. And so there's potential for more of that kind of mining. There's also a lot of oil and gas resources right there. And they are actively being extracted. So that would also be a potential problem in the future. So that you need to carefully consider that.
Well, we'll go into issues of geology a bit later in the interview as well. Other examples that the Blue Ribbon Commission looked at, Sweden, Finland, Canada, a lot of them are all experiencing more success, or I should say at least further along in the process than the U.S. is in terms of siting a permanent repository. What were some of the major themes and lessons that the BRC took from these international cases?
Well, I think the major theme that we got from Sweden, from Finland, from Canada, from France, and from WIP is that the siting process has to be consent-based. It cannot be forced upon a community or a state or a province or some governmental region. The local people have to consent to it. That doesn't mean that you have to have unanimity, that everyone has to agree, but you need a majority to agree. And certainly you need those in power in the government to agree. And it's also clear that there are probably periods of time when this is more likely to happen and periods of time when it's less likely to happen for particular locations. And so part of it is, getting it happening at the right place. But, different communities have different needs and desires. The WIP community had no experience with anything nuclear, yet they were comfortable with this. What worked in Sweden were communities that were comfortable with nuclear things, that had nuclear facilities. They had tried a volunteer process. They had tried a process where they just looked at the best sites from a geologic perspective. And what worked in Sweden was finding a community that was already comfortable with nuclear facilities. So it's not going to be the same thing everywhere, but certainly consent is very important. And the process itself has to be transparent. People have to feel like they understand what's going on, that nothing's being hidden, that it is based on sound science. And from a process management side of things, a stepwise process has to be followed. You can't plan everything ahead of time.
Not only the location and the community itself, but you're also saying the timing could also be a big factor.
Timing can be a big factor. I mean, there are times when people are more open to this kind of thing. There's, one of the issues that motivated the people of Carlsbad to offer themselves up as a potential site for a repository in the first place in the 1970s was the failure of the potash mining industry.
Yes.
So they were under economic hard times. Mm-hmm. And so they had a different motivation to go forward. So if you'd asked them 10 years earlier, they probably would have said no. Mm-hmm. But so timing can be important.
To speak more about the U.S. case, currently many of the spent fuel pools at U.S. reactor sites, they're at capacity currently. An increasing amount of the fuel is being transferred into dry casks. Without a permanent repository foreseeable in the near future, what are some of the strategies that plant managers are taking to maximize the available wet and dry storage?
Well, they have been using high-density racks in the pools, so the pools have now typically four to five times the amount of fuel that they were designed originally to hold. So originally they were these low density racks held the fuel. They were basically open cages. And the high density racks are more like a honeycomb, and the steel in the walls of the honeycomb is impregnated with boron to absorb neutrons so that you can basically stuff more spent fuel in the pool without reaching criticality, without basically essentially making a reactor core again. So that's one way. Of course, even with those high density designs, the pools are full, as you point out. And so many utility companies have bought dry casks of some design for their spent fuel, and they're using those on site. Now, one of the Blue Ribbon Commission's recommendations is to site one or two or three, who knows how many, however many we can site, interim storage facilities, which would be essentially dry cask facilities for the most part, unless a decision was made to make a pool facility, but to have some kind of interim storage facility, especially for those reactors that are already shut down, because in the U.S. there are 10 reactors at 9 sites that are shut down and that are just existing to store spent fuel. And so if you could consolidate those, you'd save money and you'd be more secure.
With regard to the interim storage facilities, obviously, the BRC laid out a number of benefits of such facilities, but one of the concerns mentioned was that these facilities could end up being permanent storage places themselves. How do you assess the danger that such facilities create moral hazard and dilute incentives to push forth with the development of a permanent geological repository?
Well, it's an issue that must be acknowledged up front and I think dealt with. One way you could do it in the U.S., and I don't know if this would work or apply directly to other countries, but you could make some kind of legal agreement that after a certain time, X, the spent fuel, will be moved or will begin to be moved. There is a similar kind of agreement that exists, say, right now between the state of Idaho and the Navy, the nuclear Navy. And so the state of Idaho and the nuclear Navy, U.S. nuclear Navy, have agreed that by 2035, the Navy will start to move nuclear waste all out of the state of Idaho. If they do not, the state of Idaho will fine them. It's something like $60 million a day. It's a lot of money, but it's sometimes money doesn't mean so much, especially to something like the federal government of the U.S. But the additional proviso is that the state of Idaho will not allow the importation of any more spent fuel. And that's what really scares the Navy. They feel like that might stop their submarine program completely because they need to offload that spent fuel from their submarines to keep them operating. So the Navy takes this agreement very seriously and they are working hard to try to find a resolution. So you could have a similar kind of agreement.
Dry casks, they have limited shelf lives of typically how many years, decades?
Yeah, that's a problem.
Okay.
In the U.S., casks were licensed for 20 years, and a number of those, the first casks were put into operation in the U.S. nearby here in Virginia in 1985, and those casks in 2005, their licenses expired. Well, their licenses were renewed for another 20 years, so they'll probably last for 40 years. What happens after 60 or 100 years, we're not sure. And so that's an active area of research right now.
One of the benefits of interim storage facilities that the BRC mentioned was that they could provide certain advantages in studying the degradation or the aging of dry casks. How would such interim storage facilities be better places to conduct this research than just the reactor sites themselves?
Well, they wouldn't necessarily be better, but certainly if they're operated by some federal corporation, as we had suggested, some nuclear waste management organization, then it makes it a little more obvious to conduct and easier to conduct research at such a facility than asking permission of the utility to use their casks on site. I mean, the best option would be to do both simultaneously.
What would the actual process be of transporting fuel currently stored in dry casks at reactor sites or even interim storage sites, as you had suggested, to a permanent repository?
Well, it largely depends on whether the spent fuel is in transportation licensed casks right now. If they are, then you just plop those casks on a rail car or heavy haul truck and you can get them going. If they're not, then you have to put them into a transportation license cask. Now, there are a number of casks now on the market that are dual purpose, transportation and storage casks. And actually, in the 1980s and 90s, the DOE had wanted to build or design what they called a multi-purpose cask, which would be for storage, transport, and disposal. But that never ended up getting off the ground. It's something that makes a lot of sense. You don't have to keep buying these things and paying for them, but it just never happened.
Basically, they had made some attempts to standardize the cask design.
Yeah. You'd have to design something that would work in the repository environment that you're using, too. So that makes it more complicated.
For the U.S., currently the country with the largest stock of nuclear waste in the world and also the largest nuclear waste producer, what would the approximate volume of a permanent repository have to be in order to adequately store all the waste that has been produced and will be produced in the future?
Well, assuming that we don't build new reactors, now it looks like we're going to build 4 maybe right now, but assuming that we don't build many more than those, it's about 120,000 metric tons. Of spent nuclear fuel. And then there is an additional 10 to 20,000 metric tons of high-level waste and spent nuclear fuel from the nuclear weapons complex that would have to be accounted for. So that's, you know, a mass of 140,000, give or take, metric tons. And 1 gigawatt power plant will produce about 20 metric tons a year, so depending on how long it operates. And that's, you know, assuming that it operates with a fairly high capacity factor. So anyway, that's sort of the issue. But in terms of the capacity of the repository, the capacity of the repository is determined by the heat production and the concentration of specific kinds of radionuclides. So it's not directly related to the volume.
In a conference that Global America Business Institute co-hosted with Federation of American Scientists back in February, you stated that the geologic media, whether salt, granite, clay, and so forth, it's not the only consideration, but that you also have to take into account seismic activity, fractures in formations, and so forth. However, is there a particular factor that carries more weight than the others?
In my mind, there is a particular factor that carries more weight than all of those that you mentioned, and that is whether the site offers a chemically reducing environment or an oxidizing environment. And what I mean by oxidizing is when there is free oxygen present, and that was the plan for Yucca Mountain. The drifts, the tunnels into which the waste would be emplaced would not be backfilled with any crushed rock or anything. They would have these titanium drip shields, which are sort of upside-down U-shaped devices that would go over the casks, but nothing else in the tunnel. Many other countries are planning on backfilling. That means you have to let the waste cool because the backfill material is an absorbent type of mineral, which is very sensitive to temperature. So you don't want to heat it too much, because then you dewater it and you lose its radionuclide absorbing properties. So you have to cool your waste. You have to let it sit around for 100 years or so before you put it underground. Now, the U.S. in its plan had wanted to put it away as quickly as possible. But the advantage of a chemically reducing environment when there's no free oxygen present, and by the way, these environments are found either in salt or below the water table. So water is, in fact, your friend in nuclear waste disposal. The reason why this is an advantage is that spent fuel, which is basically uranium dioxide, is pretty non-reactive without oxygen and water together. In the presence of oxygen and water, spent fuel is pretty reactive. So if you want sort of a natural guarantee that the stuff is going to sit there for a long time, you want a chemically reducing environment, and that seems to me to be one of the most important factors here.
You have gone on record saying that there's too much focus on rock type geological media. Could you go over some of the relative advantages and disadvantages of the different rock types that have been considered?
Sure. I mean, what's been considered in the past are a whole slew of different rock types. Salt, obviously. Tuff, which is a cemented volcanic ash, which was at Yucca Mountain. Basalt, which is a dark, fine-grained igneous rock. Argillite, which is what the French are using. It's a clay-rich rock. Granite, of course, and other crystalline rocks, metamorphic rocks called gneiss, is something else that's been considered. And these all offer different advantages and disadvantages if you just look at the rock, but of course the rock is in a geologic environment, and that geologic environment may have active earthquakes, it may have volcanoes, which was the case with Yucca Mountain, and that tuff. It may be highly fractured, which can sometimes be the case with the granites and the gneisses. It may actually have a very complicated mineralogy, which could be the salt. It may have perched water bodies around it, or a hydrologic system that actively communicates with others, which is probably undesirable. So you really, you have to take the whole thing. You can't just look at a rock type. So that's why I try to emphasize that you really need to look at the whole package.
The Blue Ribbon Commission report mentioned both retrievability and reversibility as important considerations for repository siting. Could you talk a bit about these concepts and their relative importance in current considerations in selecting a suitable repository site?
Right. Well, one, it has to do with whether you can actually go and retrieve the waste if you decide that you want to use it in the future or whatever. And one has to do with whether you can reverse the process. I think these are largely societal issues, and I think that you have to do what society feels comfortable with. So I know in France this is a very big issue, and so they have built a reversibility, a retrievability into the whole process so that people are comfortable in case something goes wrong in the future. This whole process can be reversed. From my position as a geologist, I look at it and say, well, we can pretty much mine into anything, so it will pretty much, you know, de facto be reversible and therefore retrievable. So I think it's not so much of an issue on the technical side, unless it inhibits using a certain location because you decide it wouldn't be retrievable in that sense.
You mentioned a bit earlier that water is your friend when it comes to nuclear waste disposal. There have been some proposals to do subseabed disposal as well. Could you talk a little bit about
that? Sure. The idea is to emplace the wastes in the deep sea muds that exist, you know, some kilometers below the ocean surface. And because these are anoxic, anaerobic environments, one imagines they're pretty stable geologically, and so the idea is you could put spent nuclear fuel in a torpedo-like shaped object, and then just let it find its way to the muds, and when it gets into the muds, it will, you know, bury itself. The problem with this, it sounds interesting. But the problem with this is then you're sharing your problem with everybody in the world because these are international waters, and I doubt very much you will get agreement from the international community to allow this to happen. So in that sense, it's dead in the water.
A number of initiatives on international spent fuel storage facilities have involved siting repositories on uninhabited or remote islands. From your expertise on the physical nature and surroundings of proposed storage sites in general, are there any pros and cons to this?
I guess there's a pro in the sense that if you can get political agreement on this, that's probably a good thing. You have to make sure that they're uninhabited. You know, it's like 600 people doesn't mean uninhabited. It means there are actually 600 people living there that would be impacted. And the other disadvantage that's would basically cause me not to do this is the impending sea level rise associated with climate change. So I would be very, very cautious about pursuing this option.
Another method of disposal discussed by the BRC report, although it is less understood, was deep boreholes. Could you talk a little bit more about boreholes and the advantages and disadvantages of this particular method relative to the standard geologic repository?
Sure. I think this is an interesting idea. The idea is to emplace the waste in a borehole that's drilled about 5 kilometers down, and you emplace it in the lower 2 to 5 kilometers. Now, one of the limitations is the diameter of the borehole, which is limited to about 45 centimeters to go that far down. So that means you're looking at putting individual spent fuel assemblies down this. I think it's interesting in that you could put these things almost anywhere, and you'll have adequate geology that deep. So you could sort of share the burden. And in a way, it's much less of a impact than a big mine, and less of a footprint than a mine. We're pretty sure that you get that deep, you're way below potable water supplies, and so you just have to make sure that there is no way that the borehole itself causes any aquifers to interact with each other. And you have to make sure of things like what happens if one of the fuel assemblies gets stuck on the way down. How do you solve that problem? With all the fracking that's being done in the United States now, we're becoming more and more aware of sort of these unforeseen problems that are emerging, you know, earthquakes, for instance, and that kind of thing. I don't think you'd be having any earthquakes by building boreholes because you're not putting a lot of material down like you are when you put wastewater down these things for fracking. But you have to be aware of some of these unforeseen impacts. At the same time, I think it's an idea that definitely merits more exploration. In the United States, with the current volume of spent nuclear fuel, we would need about 1,000 boreholes.
How much more time and research is needed to determine the feasibility and the practicality of using boreholes?
I'd say another, 10-15 years. We should have a lot. As long as adequate resources are putting into the R&D, we should have a better idea of how this works.
Although it's widely held that reprocessing is currently not economically viable, and the BRC itself concluded that no reprocessing technologies would significantly affect the need for a repository, what potential impact could reprocessing have on spent fuel storage in the future?
So I don't think reprocessing is going to impact the need for a repository. We're going to need one no matter what. If fast reactors improve significantly over the next 20 years, then maybe there will be a small reduction in the capacity needed. But overall, I think we're still going to be stuck with a large capacity, especially required for a repository, especially in the next 10, 20, 30 years. You know, what France is doing and what Japan had started to do, and who knows what they're going to do now, but what France is doing is using reprocessing to extract plutonium to make mixed oxide or MOX fuel. They use that MOX fuel once, and they don't use it again because they can't. The isotopics have changed so that it's not usable in a light water reactor. That's now spent fuel. Now, great, you could throw that in a repository, but the one thing to keep in mind is that gives off 3 to 4 times more heat over the long term than an equivalent spent LEU fuel will. So it doesn't really impact the needs of the repository. And you always have to remember with reprocessing that you have created vast quantities of low-level waste and other quantities of intermediate-level waste. That intermediate-level waste also requires a repository. So this means that you have complicated things in a sense. As long as you have a place to put that low-level waste, that's great. But in the United States, we have a problem even finding places for our low-level waste. So it's an issue for us. Then you have to decommission more facilities, and it costs more to do it. And while uranium's cheap, probably for the next century, it's going to cost more. So I don't see that it offers any advantages over the current, you know, ones through cycle.
Professor McFarland, this has been a truly informative and educational interview. Thank you so much again for your time and offering your knowledge on these issues.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.